Welcome, and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star, then one on your phone at any time to be placed in a queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment to less than 1 minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administering the session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Jeff Wong. You may begin.
Thank you. So good morning to you all. Welcome to the members of the subcommittee, Green Ribbon Science Panel. I'd like to welcome other members of the Green Ribbon Science Panel who may be in attendance in the listen-only mode, and like to especially welcome the members of the public who have joined us physically in each of the locations and those who are, you are on the call. Just a reminder, this is an open meeting and it's on the record. Today we are going to talk about the or have a discussion about tiered approaches to alternatives assessment. In the past, the first round of subcommittee meetings focused on the, if you think about the chart that has been up on our website, which diagram sort of diagrammed the regulation structure, we focused on the sort of the left-hand side of it, focusing on hazard, the toxicology, and et cetera, related to products or chemicals. And now we're trying to focus on alternatives assessment. We've had two prior subcommittee meetings focusing on alternatives assessment. We've talked about the general infrastructure of alternatives assessment, and we've talked about the quality of data that may go into the alternatives assessment. And today, this subcommittee is going to try to provide the agency some input on how alternatives assessments might be tiered and what kinds of considerations needed to accomplish that end. So with that, again, welcome to you all, and I turn it back now to Kathy.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. And what I'm going to do right now is do a brief roll call of the Green Ribbon Science Panel subcommittee members. And I believe there's a couple that, several that we're still expecting that haven't come on the call yet, so we're hoping that they can join us. So we'll start with Kelly Moran.
Present.
Richard Dennison.
Here.
Hey, great. Mike Kirshner.
Present.
Meg Schwartzman.
Here.
Ann Wallen. Bruce Cord.
Here.
And member Rich Liroff was not able to join us this morning, just so that you know. Before I do a round the room here, let me ask panel members, do we have any members of the public visiting with you this morning?
None here in St. Paul.
Not here in San Francisco.
Not in Berkeley.
Not in D.C.
Okay, and we have one member of the public here in Sacramento. Just to let you know. And our fearless leader, Odette Madriego, is on the line as well. She's had some surgery on her foot and is still recovering, so she's listening in today. So she's here. And here in the room, we have Jeff Wong.
Colleen Heck.
Hortensia Moniz.
Ellie Kirkpatrick.
And Tom Jacobs.
Sorry, as well as myself.
It's okay. So I want to just remind people that we're recording the meeting, and we will be posting that probably this afternoon. And for members of the public, remember that you press star 1 to queue up to make public comment when we get to that portion of the agenda. And you can do that at any time. It's actually helpful if you do it sooner rather than later. And for the subcommittee members, you can mute your line by pressing star 6 and then unmute as well. I'm going to turn it back over to Jeff for a brief agenda review, and then Hortensia Moniz is going to do the review of our document for Odette this morning.
Thank you, Kathy. Okay, so again, I will provide a review of the agenda. Director Debbie Raphael, she fell, could not be here today. She was called away And as you heard, Odette is on the line, but we're filling in for Odette. So today, I will serve as your chair. I will not have the skilled diplomacy as Dr. Geiser. I will not have the brilliance of Dr. Carroll, and I will be much less eloquent than Director Raphael. But I hope to be very methodical in our approach, gathering your insights and wisdom so patients is worth your care. This will be a working session. We will have a second session on June 14th, which is Tuesday. We are working together toward a July 14th, 15th physical meeting here in Sacramento at headquarters of Cali VA. I want to remind you that while I am with the department, I'm here to facilitate the discussion, and if you have any questions, I will not necessarily respond, and I would prefer that the staff respond to the questions wherever is appropriate. We're here to discuss issues related to the tiering of the AAs. The topic paper has been prepared by Odette and the staff, and a 500 pages worth of attachments, which I hope you have all memorized and have reviewed. So today, the agenda, again, Hortensia will eventually provide an overview after I get done speaking. That will be followed by a formal public comment period at around 10:30 or so. If we keep with the schedule, we may begin our discussion at 11. There will be a five-minute break. And then I hope to move in 15 to 20-minute increments through each one of the questions that are listed in the topic paper. My idea would be that we could get a quick overview of your comments with each question, and then ultimately revisit your points the subsequent meeting on the 14th. So that's kind of the plan, let's see how that works. Thank you.
And this is Kathy. I wanted to make one more comment, or actually two more comments. I'd like to ask the panel members to identify themselves by name when they're speaking, so that everybody knows who's talking. I'd like to remind the members of the public, we just have the one public comment period where you're going to hear about the topic. Hortensia is going to review the questions that we're asking for discussion. And that is finished. There will be one public comment period. So just wanted to make sure that you know that. And again, you can press star 1 to get in the queue to make comment to the Green Ribbon Science Panel Subcommittee. I'll turn it over to Hortensia.
Hortensia, just briefly going over the overview of today's discussion is Topic 2, Tiered and Alternatives Assessment. Under AB 1879, Health and Safety Code Section 25253, DTSC is required to adopt regulations that establish a process for evaluating chemicals of concern in consumer products and their potential alternatives to determine how best to limit exposure to reduce the level of hazard posed by a chemical of concern. The statute further requires that this process include an evaluation of the availability of potential alternatives.
Excuse me, Ann Wallen joins.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Dr. Wallen.
Thank you.
And going on, and to address potential hazards posed by those alternatives, as well as an evaluation of critical exposure pathways. The alternatives assessment process is required to include life cycle assessment tools that, at a minimum, take into consideration all of the following, and it's A through M. I won't read each one of them, but further on in the discussion, it'll be those 13 that we're referring to. Health and Safety Code Section 25253B provides the authority for the imposition of regulatory responses following the completion of an alternatives assessment or analysis. Many stakeholders have urged that DTSC develop regulations that allow manufacturers to do a less complex or a tiered alternatives assessment. Many of the same stakeholders want to see regulatory responses imposed upon completion of a streamlined AA rather than waiting until the completion of a more complex AA as called for in the statute. Basic tiered AA concepts that have been suggested to date include the following. Concept 1, is that the lower, less complex tier would not include consideration of the full range of A through M above. An example might be that the design for the environment evaluation process, as is included in attachment 2-2, could be used. Using this type of approach could perhaps be accomplished by allowing a manufacturer to do a lower tiered AA if the manufacturer agreed to implement a DTSC-determined regulatory response upon completion of that lower tiered AA. That's concept one. For concept two, all tiers would include consideration of the full 13 AA factors listed in section 25253, but the rigor of the required data and evaluation would increase from the lowest to the highest tier. For example, tier one would have only qualitative responses to a list of evaluation questions to be specified by DTSC. One model that has been suggested is the California or the CEQA equivalent checklist. Tier two, this tier would require a quantitative assessment of impacts using existing literature and test results. And tier three, this tier would apply when the manufacturer or DTSC, following the completion of a tier two AA, determines that the assessment of one or more impacts requires the development of a new scientific data and a running of environmental models. Further, the list of attachments, I won't be going through them, but that's been provided to you through an email. And going on to the questions. Taking into account those two different concepts, first question that we would be discussing today is question 2A, which of the above or other approaches should be used for developing a Tier AA process? Should the tiers be distinguished by the scope of factors required to be evaluated? Or should the tiers be distinguished by the required robustness of the data gathering and analysis, or is there any other ideas? Question 2B, if the tiers are distinguished by the scope of factors to be evaluated, how many tiers should there be? And what elements should be required to be included for such tiered AA approaches? Public health impacts associated with a chemical of concern, environmental impacts associated with a chemical of concern, exposure potential, public health and environmental impacts, product function and performance, and economic impact. Question 2C, what data or other information should be required to be obtained or developed and evaluated to support each AA tier? Could there be a minimum requirement for documentation for each element of a tier AA? If so, what should they be? Question 2D, what should be the circumstances or conditions for allowing a manufacturer to conduct a lower tiered AA? Chemical substitution versus product design, availability of known alternatives, availability of previously completed relevant AAs, or is there any other ideas? Question 2E, how or should lower tiered AAs be linked to the different types of regulatory responses? And finally, question 2F, if there's any other ideas or questions that you may suggest.
Thank you.
Okay. Tricia?
Yes.
We're ready to do the public comment now.
At this time, if you would like to provide comments to the Green Ribbon Science Panel subcommittee members on today's topic, please press star then one and ensure your line is not muted. You will be prompted to record your name. Stating your name and affiliation is optional. However, providing at least an identifying alias will assist us in managing the session. Again, pressing star then one will enable you to join the queue and make a comment. If you wish to be removed from the queue, press star then two. At this time, we do have one in queue, and I'd like to turn the call over back to Mr. Jeff Wong.
All right.
Want me to do it?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm going to be Jeff for a moment. And I'd like to query members of the subcommittee if you have any members of the public in your location and if they want to make a public comment.
No one here in St. Paul.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we already heard that there was nobody at the location. And you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. I'm assuming that there are no members of the public, and Mr. Jacobs is not going to make comment here. So, Tricia, let's go ahead and go to the phone.
That comment was removed.
Oh. Okay.
Please stand by. Just a moment. Another one came in.
Great. Thanks.
Don Ulrich, your line is open.
Thank you, and good morning, members of the panel. My name is John Ulrich. I'm the Executive Director of the Chemical Industry Council and co-chair of the Green Chemistry Alliance. I'd like to make two very quick points, if I may.
John?
First of all, yes, Jeff.
John, you can have up to 3 minutes, so don't feel like you have to rush like yesterday.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. All right. Let me be brief, nevertheless. With regard to the topic papers, concept number one, it seems to suggest that there are some voluntary collaborative opportunities for the business community to work with DTSC in order to expedite an alternatives assessment and agree to some regulatory actions as a consequence. I just want to say that voluntary actions have a very strong motivating factor for many of our companies, and this particular concept deserves some additional consideration. The second point I'd like to make deals with what I would suggest would be a rush to regulate products, priority products, containing chemicals of concern, which, quote, we all know are bad actors, unquote. The problem is that rarely are these chemicals of concern or priority products ever identified other than those that we already have suggested are covered under regulation or legislation in the state of California, which leaves open an awful lot to the imagination in terms of what we all know to be bad actors. So I would suggest, again, that the Green Chemistry Alliance believes that the AA process should be aimed at expediting the administrative procedure or the administrative, the alternatives assessment for the purpose of getting to the correct scientific answer rather than expediting it for the regulation that would maybe appended at the end. The scientific answer, I think, is the most important and should not be compromised in the process. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Are there any other public comments?
I show no other questions at this time.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I guess that brings that to a close. Thank you. So this will begin the deliberations by the subcommittee. They're actually ahead of schedule, so that's good. First, before we begin, I'd like to, as we save this to the last, I'd really like to thank Kathy and Odette and the staff for the hard work that's gone into the preparation of the material and the layout of this meeting. Next is that Director Rafael has provided us with an organizing mantra related to the future regulation. She has stated to us that the reg must be practical, meaningful, and legally defensible. Those are her overarching goals. As I said before, we had two other subcommittee meetings, again, addressing data quality and the infrastructure needed for an AA. Professor Malloy provided us with some design principles for an AA: transparency, consistency, rigor, and proportionality and response. Dr. Quinn provided us some groupings of the elements A through M. She grouped some as hazard-related, others as LCA-related, and others as optional. These design concepts to be helpful. So today, as all of you are looking at the elements A through M, thinking about tiering, and looking at the questions listed in the topic paper, I really do appreciate your participation and your discussion. I did mention earlier that I will attempt to be methodical, and so for the convenience of the staff that has to record your discussion, I would ask, when you provide your input, that is input that you think that we should record, I would ask you to think about the concept of the critical few. So when you have some points to make and you want us to record them, I ask you to say, you know, I have 3 points that I think are important, number one, number two, number three. That'll make it easier on the folks developing the record for our effort, and I think it'll be easier for you to review what your previous statements were. And it's going to help you doing your homework later that we will talk about at the end of the meeting. We are seeking your comments as individuals. We're not voting, and we're not attempting to reach consensus. So please keep that in mind. I'd like for us to now go to the questions, and I think we want to collect your input in this session. And then again, hopefully, if possible, if we can make it all the way through all of the questions, we will then revisit them at the next session, and there can be some refined discussion of refinements and your ideas related to the responses. So that's my plan. Obviously, that plan is written in sand, and we know that things can change. But I hope that works for all of us. So the first thing I'd like to do is probably spend about 20 minutes or so, if necessary, on any kind of clarifying questions that you have for the agency. So with that, floor is open.
Hi, Jeff. This is Richard Dennison.
Hi, Richard.
I do have I think just one question. And it has to do with concept one that's in the, I think, was read out. It suggests that there's the potential to conduct an AA that does not include all of the statutory factors, and that would be made dependent on whether or not the manufacturer was okay with that, essentially, I think, is the way I would read this. So I have two questions. One is, is it the legal opinion of DTSC that an alternatives analysis that does not include all of the factors is potentially an option? And if so, are there any constraints or restrictions or boundaries on under what circumstances that would be acceptable?
Richard, this is Colleen Heck. Let me just start by saying I would not have phrased concept one as it's phrased in the topic paper that is put together here, because for the very reasons that are implied within your question. That being said, I don't mean to say that there's zero flexibility to do something short of full-blown alternatives analysis in every case, that there has to be a one-size-fits-all for satisfying the A through M requirements. So clearly concept two doesn't raise any of the same sort of legal questions or sensitivities. Back to concept one, although your question is properly worded as a, you know, is it the department's legal opinion, the policy, the science, and the law kind of all intersect here. And I'd like Odette, if she's able to maybe rephrase what she was trying to capture here in her drafting of this this topic statement. Are you with us, Odette?
I'm here. And I'm trying to think how, and maybe you have an idea how you would rephrase it, Colleen, that might be better than mine, but this is obviously an area that has been challenging for us, given the length of the list of factors the statute says must be included in an alternatives assessment, and the fact that we've gotten a lot of feedback saying that in many cases that may not be necessary to look at all of those factors. There's also the concept that people want us to get to regulatory responses, and my personal reading, and Colleen, please jump in if you disagree with me, is that in order for us to impose a regulatory response under the statute, it would have to follow an alternatives assessment that addressed all of those listed factors.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
Okay. So what I was trying to come up with something creative, and this is obviously something that would need further legal assessment. But before we go down that path, I really wanted the group's take on whether or not this is something that's really worth trying to flush out. And it's the concept that if, you know, if let's say we identify certain circumstances under which we think a tiered, a less robust AA is appropriate, that we would, we don't want to negate our ability to impose regulatory responses when appropriate. And so the only way that I could think of to tie those two concepts together is some sort of a scheme where we would say to the manufacturer, you have two choices here. You can do a full-blown alternatives assessment, and then we'll impose the appropriate regulatory response. Or if we think it's appropriate, you can do this less rigorous AA. But in order to go down that path, you would have to agree to a regulatory response. That was kind of my concept. And Colleen, you may want to comment on that.
What I think might be the most productive thing is let's see how the conversation goes. If we can sort of table the legalities of this, and because there's some complicated legal concepts embedded in your policy concept, Odette, such as in essence, some manufacturer may be volunteering for a regulatory response that's more rigorous than otherwise may have come, and in exchange for that, gets a less robust or comprehensive AA. So it might be viewed as outside this literal program as a voluntary component, if you will, at least in part. So I'm not comfortable kind of dissecting that right here on the fly.
I agree.
But I think, you know, Richard makes an excellent point with his question, and it will need further setting of boundary conditions, as the scientists say, from a legal standpoint. But I think it's not beyond the pale. In other words, it merits the attention and time of the subcommittee to proceed, and we're well aware that this needs to be made to conform to the statute in one fashion or another as we develop actual regulatory language. I don't mean to dodge your question, Richard, but I think we might be best to say that's probably the most we can say on this topic for right now.
This is Meg Schwarzman. Could I get a clarification on the same issue?
Sure, let's try.
I may have just misunderstood the answer or something, but the thing that I hung up on about this in Concept 1 is just the notion that a manufacturer would have to agree to comply with the law. So did you, if you already explained why that isn't the case, I think I missed it.
Well, I think the last version, I didn't talk about that in great detail. It sounds to me, from what Odette was describing, that her vision is that the regulatory response might have sort of not much input loop or appeal process or dispute process from the manufacturer, that it be more of a unilaterally imposed, and may be more strenuous than would otherwise have been the result if it were the more typical AA followed by the regulatory response. Is that right, Odette?
Yes, and maybe I don't know how many people are, probably not many, but are familiar with the variance process that we have in our hazardous waste program. And under that process, somebody can apply to the department to get, in essence, a variance from a requirement that's spelled out in the law. And the department can, at its discretion, provide that variance, but typically speaking, in doing so, there are conditions attached to that. So in this case, it would be a situation where a manufacturer would ask to be able to perform an alternatives assessment that is less rigorous than that that is spelled out in the statute, but as a condition for the department's approval for that, there would be conceivably some sort of appropriate regulatory response attached to it. And again, as Colleen says, this is a very, you know, complicated legal issue, and this is something where we are we're trying to look at some creative ways that we could build in tiered AA. So it's my recommendation that rather than spending too much time on the legal discussion, we can do that separately, but what we'd really need is your advice on, assuming we can make this happen, what would that tiered AA look like?
Hey, thanks.
Thanks, Odette.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Odette. So, again, Richard and Meg, do you have any follow-up to that?
This is Mike. I've got a, Mike Kirshner. I have a clarifying question also.
Okay. Then, Mike, go ahead.
All right, this might be a stupid question, so I just preface it with that. This has confused me for a while. It says that the AA process is required to include life cycle assessment tools that at a minimum take into consideration all the following, blah, blah, blah. That's just talking about the tools. It's not talking about what the actual alternative assessment needs to consist of. Am I missing something here? Because when I think of a tool, I think of a capability that tool has. You may or may not utilize that capability in the performance of whatever action it is that tool is designed to help you take. Yet we're talking about it here as though this is the list of requirements for the alternatives assessment.
Yeah, Mike, this is Colleen again. I see your point. I think you're right. This is not the conventional usage of the term shall include life cycle assessment tools. But our best reading based on the legislative history, the actual discussions during the drafting, legislative intent language, and all of the input from the public and from other members of the department to date has been that this is just a function of, I hate to say it, inartful drafting. And that this is meant to talk about the minimally required content or topics to be addressed one fashion or another in the AA. But I can totally understand and empathize with your confusion. This is one of a handful, frankly, of drafting topics that have taken a lot of our time up to try to sort through what the legislature was actually requiring or mandating of us.
So the one thing that I want to remind everybody is that the topic papers that are prepared by ODET and staff, you know, they're not reflective of what the agency or the department is pursuing as absolute policy. These are discussion papers, so there may be things that are clearly not clear. Or you may have something that you want to debate, and that's the exact purpose of the topic paper is to draw out these kinds of comments. In terms of language, and trying to answer Mike's, I think we all struggle to come up with something that tried to reflect some prescriptiveness, some rigor, and yet have some flexibility. So I think if there's any unclarity there, that represents our struggle with trying to meet those goals. So is there any other clarifying questions or follow-up questions?
Yeah, this is Bruce Kortz. I guess one of the things that I think there's, in my own simple mind, a way to satisfy all of those, I think there's 13 different parameters. And what I'm thinking is things like product function and performance. Seems to me that that's an issue for, example, a chemical company replaces one surfactant, which is on the chemicals of concern list, with another. It's the company's responsibility, or it's their concern on whether the performance is there, and I assume that they wouldn't market a product unless they thought they had an alternative that would deliver the performance. So in that particular case, it could still be part of the criteria, but the answer is product function and performance have not been sacrificed or compromised. On the other hand, something like public health impacts of an alternative chemical, obviously more data requirements would be there. And then there's a lot of things like water consumption and energy requirements that are probably somewhere in between. Am I reading that right? Isn't that a way to get to basically fulfill the regulation or the law?
This is Odette. I don't know if I'm totally clear on your question, but I think so. It still gets down to the bottom line that we're reading the law as, you know, requiring the alternatives assessment to give consideration to the extent relevant to all of those factors.
Right, but I mean, a simple answer, I mean, under product function and performance, couldn't the response of in terms of an alternative be, we do not, the company basically believes that product function performance are not set, compromised, and not have to put any, not have to supply any data? I mean, it's their commercial success or failure. Why is it a concern of the department?
Let me try to answer it this way, Bruce. This is Colleen. From a legal standpoint, I would agree with the premise of your question that the level of data or stringency or scientific endeavor that's required to answer the A to M need not all be the same, that they won't all require the same sorts of inquiries or documentation necessarily, that we have, as Jeff alluded to, some flexibility shaping the regulations to talk about what these A to M criteria or parameters would look like. So you're right that product function or performance may well be less data-driven or intense than some of the other factors. I'm not saying we're committed to that path, but I believe that's an area where you're correct that we have some room to maneuver.
And that, in fact, is something that we are asking you to provide us with recommendations on.
Okay, thank you.
Any other clarifying questions? All right. I just want to point out that it's nice to have Dr. Wallen on the line. She is connecting from Switzerland. Is that correct?
Yes, thanks.
So it's evening time, I think around 5 o'clock your time there?
Yes, a little after 7.
Okay, after 7. All right. So thank you for being here. So my next is that we can go on and for the next 10 or 15 minutes discuss the concept number 2, or we can move along and start to address the questions A through E. Any preferences on the part of the subcommittee?
Hi, Jeff, this is Kelly. I do feel like I need to make at least provide a little information to the department regarding this, the approach that Odette was raising. And I could do that as part of answering 2A if you'd prefer.
Oh, no, go ahead, Kelly, please.
I've had some experience with both the variance process and another similar law, the pesticides regulatory framework, in regards to options other than the full regulatory program and basically deal-making by the agency to work something out with the industry. And while I think that there, I certainly wouldn't want to close the door on that, and I think that the Green Chemistry Alliance is trying to say, you know, we're willing to try to work with the department to find solutions to move things forward in a way that's going to be less onerous for everyone, which I think is enticing. I would urge some caution as the department approaches this, particularly in the regulatory structure, and I want to provide two examples to explain why I'm still cautious about this. And one is in the pesticides arena. There what happens is that the regulatory structure is such that actually completing the entire process of studying a pesticide when it is re-registered or goes through registration review, it involves lots of expensive scientific studies, and going through the whole thing can take a really long time. So that's an incentive if you are willing to spend the money to do the studies and have it take another 10 years while your product can continue to be used as it is used now. And it's a disincentive if spending the money on those studies isn't really economically a good thing for you, or if you're a company and you can kind of foresee that you really don't want to continue marketing this product because as you're learning through these studies that it's not the best environmentally and otherwise, and as good stewards, you really want to make a change. And as a result, what's been happening is EPA has been making voluntary agreements with pesticides manufacturers. And they're not done in the public eye, and they're not there's no opportunity for interest to all the various interests to be thought through all the way. And so I think the EPA and the registrants are trying really hard to be good stewards and do a good job. But some of them haven't worked very well. And there's one that's this week actually in the news, or will be in the news, which is about rodenticides, that I think is a really good example of the kinds of problems that can occur. EPA found that a whole class of rodenticides pose unreasonable risk to children, pets, and the environment and wildlife in particular, back in 2008. And instead of, since their authorities didn't provide them the ability to immediately pull those products from the market, and the manufacturers were obviously concerned about that, they worked out a deal to create an orderly transition over a three-year period ending June 4th to pull the sale of those products. Some of the manufacturers have since said that they didn't agree to this deal, and there's actually been some litigation and some other things going on. So the end result is that it's unclear that that these products, which for several years we've had a formal determination are completely unsafe for children and so on, are going to continue to be sold until everyone can figure out what to do. And this doesn't seem like a very good outcome. It's confusing to the public why products that EPA said were so dangerous that they should be pulled from the market or continue to be sold. And it's frustrating that there's not clear authorities to pull them from the market right away. So that's one example that has me concerned. I've had a lot of folks approach me about this in my professional work. The other one is the variance process that Odette mentioned, and I know that that process has been reformed, but the department is still struggling with the outcomes of the variance decisions that it made, and a really good example of that is the treated wood waste variance. We're still having trouble managing wood that is hazardous waste because of the chemicals used to treat it. And there's been various actions in the legislature and so forth about that. But for the most part, I don't think there's very good evidence that wood that is still hazardous waste at its end of life is getting properly managed today. And so it's something to think about, because I'm not feeling confident that the best interest of the states would be served by going down the road where that kind of deal making would be a primary route.
Kelly, this is Odette. Maybe I'm misreading you, but I'm hearing that you may not be so supportive of tiered AAs, or is there some other approach that you think would work?
No, that's not a comment on tiered AAs. It's a comment on doing something outside of the regulatory framework that would be established here, or establishing a regulatory framework that would include some kind of voluntary shortcutting that wouldn't be framed out in a way that might go through a process.
Okay.
So
keep in mind, just keep your mind open to the fact that to do a tiered AA and get to regulatory response, that might somehow be the road we have to go. Maybe not. Maybe we'll find a different legal way, but we're trying to look at all options here.
Absolutely. And what I'm cautioning about is doing a shortcut that might only consider one topic or one issue, or having a voluntary deal that isn't daylighted or whatever. And so it's not to say don't do it. It's to say here are a couple of examples where I think it hasn't worked out all that well, and if you kind of go look at the framework behind it, there's been a lot of public agency costs and public costs associated with them that were not anticipated when the deal making was done. So that's different than don't do it.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. It sounds, in listening in, that your admonishments to the department are consistent with Professor Malloy's design principle of transparency, the need for transparency, and the need for rigor in your two examples.
Yeah, and in fact, they kind of go towards when we come to 2A, as you'll probably guess, I'm heading towards the option 2, so required robustness of the data kind of tiering rather than the other. But we'll get there when we have that discussion.
Okay. And Odette's comments are balancing the, again, for Director Raphael's mantra of practical. So with that, do we want to, again, I'm asking for input from the subcommittee, do we want to move toward talking to about concept number two, or would you prefer to move on and try to address the questions one at a time?
Well, Jeff, this is Richard Dennison. I do want to suggest something that I think maybe is a variant or falls between concepts one and two.
Okay, please.
In life cycle assessments, there's a common convention that basically entails moving through the analysis and drawing boundaries where at a point where there is a legitimate basis for concluding that going any further would not make a difference or not make a significant difference. So, for example, if you're talking about some kind of equipment that's used to produce a packaging material, at some point you can say that the equipment used to make the equipment is not a significant additive element in the overall impact and so forth. And there's some conventions, but there are also some methodologies for kind of drawing those boundaries. In addition, many of the alternative assessment approaches that I've seen have a concept where certain things may not have to be looked at in detail or looked at very hard because an assumption can be made and justified that the alternatives are not going to differ significantly on the basis of a given factor, that essentially it would be a wash across those alternatives. So I'm wondering whether maybe it's part of what's envisioned in concept two, tier one, but would there be the ability to simplify the analysis and perhaps even eliminate any further analysis of particular factors on that list of A through M by being able to make an argument along those lines that either it represents a minimum or a minuscule contributor to the overall assessment, or the alternatives are not going to differ significantly in that dimension, and therefore further analysis is not warranted. And I don't know if that's already envisioned either in the way concept one or two is laid out, or if it's actually a different thing.
Richard, this is so dead. I think that's getting towards the concept that I was asking the group to look at. I think more along the lines, I take it back. It's one of the questions that I'd asked Subcommittee 1 to look at is that sort of sequencing type of analysis where you use some screening, if I understand you correctly.
Yes, it is in some sense a screening where there would be a rationale provided for why further analysis or no analysis of a given factor is needed.
And so I would be interested in your comments on that.
This is Meg. Could I just pick up where Richard left off? Because I think that's sort of an interesting sort of elaboration of something that I was thinking about in terms of how to look at that list of A through M and pick out what the most relevant factors are for any given substance that's being looked at. And I just wanted to check for a sec. I think on the last subcommittee call I was on, there was some difficulty hearing me. Maybe my voice was going in and out. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep, loud and clear.
Okay. I don't necessarily support or oppose use of a checklist like CEQA, but just to put it in that context, it may be that each factor, each sort of topic of an alternatives assessment, each each area of like A through M, would start with a question of that delineates on a scale, or probably not a yes-no, but some kind of scale, how much of a contributor this factor is either to what makes it a chemical or product of concern, or to the differentiation among the alternatives. So there would be some almost screening question first, that's the first question for each factor, about how big a contributor is this to the concern, and that would somehow do the narrowing of the scope in the way that everybody's looking for to make this more manageable.
Hey, this is Kelly. Can I follow up?
Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was thinking about as part of that concept of the tiered alternatives assessment that Ken and Ann and I put together for the committee last year. And the CEQA analogy is a really good one. The first thing you do when you're starting down the lines of doing an environmental impact assessment of for a proposed project is to go through each of the topic areas and say, what basic information do I have on each of these, and is this even relevant for do I need to analyze this at all? Is there evidence in the record that tells me that there's not going to be an impact in this area? And I think that analogy is perfect here, and I would certainly urge, advise the department to, as part of the structuring of alternatives assessments, to include that step, which requires some documentation of the basis for saying this is unimportant, but allows one to quickly move through and focus one's energies on those topics that matter as compared to the other topics.
This is Meg. I would just add on to that. In looking at question 2B from the topic document, there's this list of, if you were to group, and I know that Tim sent out a grouping yesterday about how to put A through M into these criteria about human health and public safety, environmental impact, resource impact, technical performance, and cost. And I appreciate Bruce's point from earlier that in taking regulatory action on the basis of an alternatives assessment or after an alternatives assessment, does it really matter that much to the department about the technical performance and cost, or is that information that the company needs itself in making choices? I think maybe those are lower priority in terms of the regulatory action. I understand why they're there, but I think there may be lower priority for regulatory action. So I guess where I was going with this is that maybe those are sort of the criteria is this a relevant factor? Maybe it can be broken down into those five areas, the five criteria on the left part of Tim's chart, and if the answer is yes, then you kind of get into the finer grain, which of these is the most relevant. I also want to, since Kelly, you took us to the document that you and Ken and Anne prepared from a year ago, the April 6th alternatives assessment process, that's kind of a draft proposal of what this might look like. It's an interesting place to start and gives us something to picture, and it connects to this point that we were just making about sort of what do the questions look like under each category. And I wanted to make sure that we're approaching this. My recommendation is that this be approached, the questions that are drafted under here, and I understand it was just a first draft, are basically framed around, does the alternative adversely affect, and then whatever factor it is. And I want to make sure, my recommendation is that the way these alternative assessments be performed and asked and laid out is regarding, for example, say, regarding water use. And then there's the little chart underneath that says original product, alternative A, alternative B, alternative C. And then you actually either quantitatively or qualitatively, depending on the requirement, indicate the water use. So
so that you actually have information about all of the products or chemicals under consideration rather than just does the specified alternative turn out worse or better on this factor. Is that clear? Does that raise any – if you didn't understand that, maybe could you ask a question?
Hey, thank you. So let's see if I can put this together. Listening to Richard, Meg, and Kelly, it sounds I hear Meg and Kelly looking for screening questions and trying to use those to identify which is important of the A through M elements. As I listen to Richard, Richard is talking about LCA in its whole, implying that it's an iterative process to define where boundaries might begin and end. Difficulty that I see is that in using a CEQA type analysis, that if you are focusing on one end of the LCA, such as maybe where the use is going on by the consumer, that it might miss important points that might occur later on, let's say at disposal. So I personally would like to hear some more input as to how screening questions can be used at different points in the product's lifetime.
This is Meg. So what if we propose three screening questions at the beginning of each category, assessment criteria? One is, you know, a summary kind of thing of, is this a major contributor to the reason that this is a chemical of concern? The next is this something that shows a major difference? Are there major differences among the alternatives around this factor? And the third, you know, at sort of a rough assessment level, and the third would be what point in the chemical or product life cycle, at what point in the chemical or product life cycle is this factor relevant?
Thank you.
Can I go back to your question, Jeff, of how you took the differences between Richard's comments versus Meg's and Kelly's? I understood Richard's comments to be pointing to an analogy we may be able to borrow from the life cycle analysis world, that there's a recognition, a convention that not everything within the LCA needs to be looked at to the nth degree, that certain points it just makes sense to stop because you've learned enough, and that that concept could be imported into the AA. Was that what you were trying to say, Richard?
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself. And that there's a similar concept of being able to set aside factors because there's a good rationale and good basis for concluding that the alternatives being looked at would not differ significantly on that parameter.
Which I think Meg just built on in her concept, too.
Right.
Right.
I was just trying to achieve some kind of integration between
okay.
the three comments.
All right. I thought I misunderstood Richard. We're good.
Yeah. Because my again, I keep going back to Professor Malloy's design parameters, and that helps with the issue of consistency.
This is Kelly.
Yes, Kelly.
And just to break in, the reason for the phrasing of the questions in that little example that we sent last year, where it showed the questions along with that flowchart. The idea was to make them essay questions as opposed to just yes, no, check, make up some number from thin air kind of thing. So that is not incongruous with what Meg's comment is. It was more that the idea that things be phrased in a way that someone would need to show their thought process in providing the response. And so that's why I was resisting the typical tables that show up in these alternative analysis screening tools, where people don't show their thought process. And then the other thing is, I think that what Jeff just said is right on target, that to really do a CEQA type screening, you would need to lay out the various steps in the life cycle to do that, to make sure that someone thought about manufacturing, the useful life, and the end of life for each of the topic areas. That's just super on target.
This is Meg. I would second that, and I think as we think about what are we trying to accomplish with laying out an alternatives assessment process, basically it's about trying to learn more, and one of the things we might learn is what is the point of impact of the life cycle of this chemical or product, and the other is data gaps, obviously, and it may just be that there's one part of the life cycle about which a lot is known and other parts about which nothing is known, and so maybe some of what's gleaned from this is just the areas that we need to know more about, and so in a sense it doesn't create something that's extra burdensome, it just requires that all of that information or lack thereof be laid out.
Thank you. The one thing from my point of view is that Kelly, she, working with Dr. Geiser and Dr. Blake, provided the attachment that you all have. One thing that I'd like to ask for some input on, not necessarily here, but possibly as a part of email traffic or homework assignment, is the rule sets or some examples of rule sets in which we can actually apply where we actually don't need data and we can make the decision to use an assumption, or where we think that the boundary condition, this is far enough and we can stop the analysis here. So I think the agency would appreciate some examples in that area. So again, now we're at around 10:35. We're definitely still on schedule, at least my schedule, and we can either move on to further discussion of Concept 2 for another 15 minutes, or we can move directly again to the questions, and I ask for the committee's input.
I'd recommend going to the questions because I think we're already talking about them.
All right. So, since we're not voting and we're not reaching consensus, it's an individual, but that individual has chosen for all of you. Question 2A is now opened up for discussion, and we'll do that for the next 15 minutes or so. And again, I appreciate the discussion, but if you have any recommendations that you like or don't like, or whatever your input is, again, I ask you to sort of be methodical in your response when you're prepared to give a response, again, so the staff can record it for the record. Thank you. The floor is open.
This is Kelly.
Kelly, go ahead.
Yeah, at the risk of talking too much here,
We appreciate your input.
Okay. Well, I recommend that the department think in a tiered AA process about the required robustness of the data gathering and analysis being the approach to tiering rather than the scope of factors. And the reason for that is that most of the examples that one hears about of regrettable substitutions, those that were deliberate substitutions rather than inadvertent substitutions, a large fraction of those seem to be ones where somebody thought about one factor but didn't think about the other consequences of it. And that's just happened so many times. People are so focused, I've got a human health hazard, we'll get rid of the human health hazard and everything will be better, and then we have water pollution. So that's the reason I think that scientifically it makes more sense to do the required robustness of the data rather than by topic area.
This is Meg. I agree with what Kelly just said, so my recommendation is closer to number 2, under 2A, than to number 1, or concept 2. I think, in a sense, there's some streamlining that could also happen under 2 that accomplishes some of what 1, that is the limiting scope of factors, attempts to accomplish by working down this line that we've been talking about identifying what sort of the hot spots are that are like why this chemical or product is flagged for concern, and where the major differences between the original product and the proposed alternative or the alternatives that are in the analysis lie, so that the answers to those two questions and the third screening question that I proposed about what part of the life cycle is this does this impact affect or derive from, that the answers to those three screening questions could basically be used to focus the alternatives assessment while avoiding what Kelly is talking about causing unintended consequences because of simply not looking. Was that a clear enough recommendation, Jeff?
Yeah. So again, if, to paraphrase, tiering is based, or it appears to me, you're asking that actually every factor, A through M, be addressed, and that the tiering is based upon whether or not an assumption can fill or a narrative can fill some of the areas, or whether a qualitative appraisal can fill, or whether or not a quantitative analysis is required. Am I hearing that right?
I guess I would, yes, and I would go beyond that to, yeah, I guess that's right, but that what would dictate it is the outcome of those first three screening questions, that that's what focuses the alternative assessment rather than simply a tier one only has to consider A through F or whatever.
All right. I understand. Any other comments?
Yeah, this is Mike.
Mike, go ahead.
I see rationale in both Kelly and Meg's suggestions that are compelling, and just looking at the substitutions that I've seen, even if I just hold it to the electronics industry, that tell me that manufacturers really do have to think about each of these areas, either internally or for the purpose of the alternative assessment itself. And they can do that qualitatively, or they can do it quantitatively. How you move from qualitative to quantitative, though, I think is going to be where some of the challenge is. But getting back to Bruce's point, which I do agree with, that A and M as well, and possibly even B, are may not have any relevance to the topic at hand. They certainly do have relevance to the manufacturer. There have been regrettable substitutions which have cost manufacturers enormous amounts of money. There have been substitutions that have, I'm thinking specifically of substitution of red phosphorus for bromine in semiconductor mold compounds to try to improve the environmental footprint, but it was a reliability disaster, so ultimately created an awful lot of scrap, which is another issue when you make a mistake like that. So each of these has to be considered to one degree or another. I think it's just in the first tier. I really like the idea that let's go through these qualitatively through the product life cycle. Assess almost to a yes or no, should I worry about this or not, and then a why I should or why I shouldn't, and that can be a tier one, and if that's adequate, then yes, it's fine, but if there's points where more data is necessary to come up with an assessment, then perhaps it's a tier two. Now, who makes the decision of whether it's a tier one or tier two? Maybe we get to that later, whether it's DTSC or the entities doing the assessment. That requires more thought.
Any other comments?
This is Richard. So I want to pick up on one of Meg's three questions, because and it's possible Julia Quinn's grouping of A through M gets at this. I haven't seen that, so if I'm repeating something there, my apologies. But some of these factors are clearly going to be related to what made that chemical in that product of concern. And some of these are not going to be that. So, for example, it may be of high concern because of public health impacts, and that means that the other factors take on the role of serving as a check that if an alternative improves against the factor that led the chemical to be identified as being of concern, does it cause an ancillary effect in one of these other areas? And some of those areas are environmental, and some of them are non-environmental. So I'm struggling with this a little bit, but I'm trying to sort of suggest a sequence here. And this concept I thought circulated last year as to what you look at first being a variant on what you ultimately have to look at. So, and are you looking at a factor because you're wanting to just make sure that an alternative is not posing a significant trade-off, versus is it a core part of the comparison that you want to make? And I can envision situations where those factors might be equally important and should be given equal weight, but other times when you really would be okay with a much less robust or in-depth analysis of a factor, because you can get to a point where you say, well, this is it's clear this is not going to be a trade-off. It's actually going to be a synergy, or it's going to be a wash. So that's kind of another idea that would be, you look at things first that get better on the parameter that made the chemical a chemical of concern in the first place. And then for those that do better on that score, you use the other factors as checks to ensure that you're not replacing one problem with another.
Thank you, Richard. So, Richard, I am thinking that you are really describing a process by which you would implement Meg's and Kelly's screening mechanism.
Well, or that even beyond the screen, that it would dictate an order in which you look at these factors, and rather than have to look at all alternatives against all factors, you would screen out some alternatives because they are no better than the chemical of concern on the factor that led that chemical to be of concern. And then you would focus further analysis of the other factors on those that were demonstrably better on that parameter. So, instead of having to fill out the entire matrix, where one dimension is every possible alternative, and the other dimension is A through M, and you have to put something in every single cell, you would first look at if it's a public health impact, you would look at how the alternatives compare on that parameter, and then only take those alternatives further into the analysis that are better on that parameter. And wasn't there a concept like this that was laid out last year? Am I not remembering that right? It was kind of a different way of thinking about tiering.
Yes, Mike, you're correct. One of the versions of the regs did lay out a similar concept.
All right, thank you. Any other comments on question 2A, Dr. Cords, Dr. Whalen?
I don't really, this is Ann Wallen. I don't have anything additional to add, but I would be very supportive of this, borrowing a concept from life cycle assessment where you essentially determine the materiality or the points of differentiation among different alternatives as a way to focus your efforts and maybe go after more robust data.
Great, thank you. And sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name.
That's fine.
I'm using my Georgia accent. All right. So, any more comments on question 2A?
This is Kelly. I guess I just want to follow up on what Richard said. I think that we, at some point, there needs to be some discussion of what constitutes an alternative that needs to go through the alternatives analysis, because I think that's where you're hearing some different things. Richard said something that I didn't agree with until I realized that he was thinking that someone might take an alternative that they could just look at and say, well, we're not going to do that, feel like they have to take that through the whole analysis. And I think that makes a lot of sense, that there should be no need to take through alternatives that one can look at and quickly say, oh, this is going to be totally unacceptable for either the same reason as the original chemical or for some other very obvious reason. And to me, that seems even a threshold before you'd be taking a look at the various topic areas.
Yeah, I would agree that the one thing that I have in terms of potential observation is that I think when whoever does the alternatives analysis, before it ever reaches our desk or before it becomes public, we may not see all of the total universe of alternatives that were considered. And we may only see the most viable alternatives. So I realize that all of your comments are consistent with the process for a total universal approach to it, and that much of it may be behind the scenes. And so it sort of tried to look at what is actually going to become viable and actually what will enter the public domain. So I'm not clear, or I'm torn between how much detail. And I think, again, we're looking for your comments and your guidance to help us with that.
This is Meg. You raised the point of whether the alternatives under consideration are in the public domain. That is, can people see, department or anyone who wants to know, which alternatives were considered? And although this isn't one of our specific questions, my sense is that this entire process is the utility of it is completely subverted if it's not possible to see the range of alternatives that are considered. And one of the things that I think was in the some prior version of the regs was the opportunity for public input into what alternatives should be considered, which to me is the greatest opportunity for this process to actually stimulate innovation, that somebody with an alternative, an idea for an alternative who doesn't have a reason to have market share at this point can step forward and say, here, I see the list of alternatives you've put. Well, I have another. This may be more than this call can take up at this point, but because you brought up the issue of whether the range of alternatives considered is transparent, I feel the need to weigh in with that.
Okay, thank you. Again, be reminded that we are mindful of the, again, as I stated earlier, one of the design criteria that Professor Malloy laid out, and that is transparency. So we are mindful of that. So let's, there's no further discussion on question 2A. Let's begin this question of question 2B for the next 5 minutes or so, and then we'll take a break and then return to question 2B. With that, have any comments on question 2B?
I have kind of a housekeeping observation slash question, which is, I don't believe there was any support expressed by any of the subcommittee members or scope be determinative. So I wonder if we should rephrase 2B or unburden the panel members from assuming they have to answer it exactly as phrased, and maybe see if they want a little more freewheeling discussion of 2B. I don't know if that works for them.
Okay, so this is Jeff. Again, these are just to stimulate discussion. Nobody is bounded by this. Meg is an example. We just had a brief comment about transparency of the process. So again, we welcome any comments and any reformulations or whatever comments that the subcommittee would like to offer. So again, any comments with question 2B?
Jeff, this is Kelly.
Yes, Kelly.
This kind of goes between 2A and 2C, so it's kind of a 2B comment. But you had asked about what examples of regulatory standards for setting boundaries. And in CEQA, there's this concept of focusing out topics. So basically, you go through the initial study checklist, which you guys showed there, and you explain the rationale that you use if you're not going to do a more detailed analysis of something, and the jargon for that is focusing out. And if you'd have to ask an attorney for this. I can't point to the code section or the CEQA guidelines section that says it, but I believe the standard for that is substantial evidence in the record. So it's actually a legal standard. So basically, you can respond to the thing and says, you know, is there a seismic safety hazard at the site? And you can say, no, it's, you know, there's, we've looked at a map and it shows us that ground shaking would be no more than X. And you cite the source and then you're done. You don't have to go back and do anything else. And your citation is substantial evidence in the record. And I'm seeing that here as a way to be able to get between the huge long laundry list of all the various topics and getting to what really needs to, what deserves the investment and thinking in evaluation of alternatives would be to try to use that kind of same approach and standard. So in summary, what I'd be suggesting would be that the department take a look at the CEQA standards for focusing out, and I think that phrase is substantial evidence in the record.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm looking at Colleen, our attorney, and she's like shaking her head up and down.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent suggestion to look to the ability to focus on the more important criteria and the related concept of what the standard is for saying we can move past this as not critical. So we'll certainly take a look at that, the CEQA analog, Kelly. I think that's an excellent suggestion.
This is Mike Kirshner. Just to follow up on that, I also think that's a really interesting idea. I'm not sure that it's going to be applicable to the non-environment related topics, function, useful life, and economic impact, because there won't be data in any record for that except proprietary corporate records, which are not going to be released, transparent or not, transparency desired or not. So, but otherwise, where we are talking about chemical properties that are related to human health and safety, environmental impact, resource impact, perhaps there we can have a that sort of gate to go through.
Mike, this is Colleen again. I think that's a a very accurate observation about the robustness of the data and the ease of use that will vary among the A to M requirements. But I would just, if I may, modify your observation about transparency just one little bit, which is we need to continue to keep in mind that there's a difference between what a manufacturer submits to the department under some claim of trade secret. There's an obligation in, or the department may impose an obligation on parties to provide information that it would otherwise regard as trade secret. The way that's handled and that obviously the business advantage that was paid for is maintained is the department gets to see it, the rest of the world does not. So a manufacturer may be able to fill in some of these A to M with proprietary or trade secret information, still have that information protected.
Okay, yeah, if that level of granularity is allowed in the trade secret information, then...
Yeah, and in fact, from the lawyer's point of view, it's not granularity. It's a huge distinction to keep in mind that we can see data and protect it from its further dissemination, and we still get what we need for our regulatory role, and the business gets its needs met to be protected from having that material distributed any further than the department. I didn't mean to harp on the point, but it's one that's come up in all of the subcommittee topics directly or indirectly, distinction between what's submitted under a claim of trade secret, what does that mean, and what does it not mean.
Okay. All right. I understand that. Then it goes back to an issue of relevance.
Correct.
And somehow in the qualitative end of this, we have to set define to what degree relevance to the issue is important and how that's to be addressed.
Right.
All right. Thank you. It is by our clock 11:01. And I'd like to break for 5 minutes and come back at 11:06 our time. So, again, we'll break now for 5 minutes. Thank you.
All righty, we're back.
Hello?
Hi. Hi.
Great. Awesome.
Hi.
So who's back? Dr. Cords?
I'm here.
Dr. Kirshner?
Here.
Tennyson?
Here.
Dr. Moran?
Yeah, I'm with Kirshner.
Okay, that's right. Sorry. Dr. Schwartzman?
Here.
Dr. Whalen?
Well, here.
Sorry, I keep mispronouncing your name.
Not a problem.
The cat is kicking me. All right, so let's move on. We did have some discussion around question 2B and 2A. So if there are any, as when people went away for the break and now they've returned, do they have any additional ideas, comments, or input for the agency on 2A and 2B?
This is Richard, Richard Dennison. So I think I better raise this now. I was going to wait till question 2E, but I've been wrestling with this. The main issue is we have a set of regulatory responses that ultimately can't be reached until the alternatives assessment is completed. And I want to relate those regulatory responses back to this question of scope and tiering, because I think it may, in fact, influence, in particular, the scope of factors. The thing that strikes me about that list of regulatory authorities is that none of them explicitly have any explicit relationship to whether or not alternatives are available. Some of them have an implicit linkage. So if you're talking about restricting the use of a chemical, you may want to think about what it would be replaced with, and that's implicit. But it's not like the regulatory authority is for BTSC to say you must use X instead of Y. But some of the regulatory responses, I would argue, have no relationship whatsoever to the availability of alternatives. And in particular, if you have that list of 1 through 9 from the statute that was provided as attachment 2.1, certainly 3 and 6 and 7 have no direct or indirect link that I can see to the availability of an alternative. So let's imagine we have a product where the concern about that product is releases associated with the end of its life. And the logical regulatory response is to impose a control on the end of life. But the only way to get to that regulatory response based on the statutory language is to have completed an alternatives analysis. I would argue that ought to provide some, not only lead to a desire to have a less onerous alternatives assessment, but it may actually drive which factors, A through M, need to be looked at and which ones don't. Now, I haven't taken the concept too much further than that, but one of those factors, A through M, J, is end of life. And I guess I'm still struggling with the degree to which the regulatory response that is contemplated to deal with the reason why the chemical was prioritized in the first place shouldn't be a factor in the scope and or robustness of the alternatives assessment that has to be completed in order to get to that regulatory response.
Richard, you want to de-link the scope or robustness of the AA from what the appropriate regulatory response might be or how one arrives at the appropriate regulatory response?
I actually think, Colleen, I'm saying they should be linked.
Okay. I thought that's what you were leading up to. I lost you there at the end.
Sorry, I may have used a double negative in there.
Okay. No, that's okay.
This is Meg. I've struggled with very much the same point, particularly after reviewing that list of regulatory responses and seeing, like Richard pointed out, that A, the statute doesn't actually require that the regulatory response be a response to the alternatives assessment. It just requires that it follow in a time series the completion of the alternatives assessment. And also that several of them are quite independent. Those responses are quite independent of the availability of or trade-offs entailed in an alternative. The problem, and so I understand Richard's kind of leaning or exploring this idea of linking the extent of the kind of scope of the alternatives assessment that would be required to the expected regulatory response. The thing that really holds me back from feeling like I would get behind a recommendation like that is that it presupposes, so end-of-life management could be a regulatory response that would be very useful, you know, if that's been identified as a point of the life cycle that's problematic. But that ideally, actually, the ultimate solution would be to find a non-hazardous way of accomplishing the same goal that the chemical of concern that poses a problem at the end of life serves. So permitting a very truncated alternatives analysis to get to the point of end-of-life control presupposes that alternatives would the potential alternatives would have the same life cycle, or the impact at the same point in the life cycle. So, and it also presupposes that the only way to solve the problem is through an end-of-life control. So I worry that using the anticipated response to drive the scope of the alternatives assessment closes down the opportunities to find creative and truly successful alternatives. And it closes the process down to the kind of end of pipe or sort of minimizing exposure, that kind of thing, solutions that have kind of plagued the whole system to date.
So I totally get that. But there's a trade-off in both directions here, because if the alternatives assessment is required to be, you know, all the bells and whistles, and it really has very little bearing on the ultimate regulatory response, I can imagine situations where that is the case, as well as situations where, of the sort you described, Meg, where the alternatives assessment might provide, you know, an even better solution than one would get without it. And so, but the trade-off is that if you can't get to the regulatory response relatively quickly, even when that regulatory response, A, is obvious, or B, has no bearing on the availability of alternatives, that also is a problem. So maybe it's not a matter of, you know, one or the other, but I'm suggesting that it ought to be a factor in either sequencing this process. So, for example, the initial scope or robustness of the alternatives assessment that needs to be completed in order to get to a particular regulatory response may be able to be streamlined in some fashion because of the fact that regulatory response is urgent or is clearly one of the regulatory responses needed. And then that process, that a more thorough alternatives analysis is done subsequent to that that may inform additional regulatory responses. That might be one thought. It's trying to strike the right balance between being able to take obvious and needed actions expeditiously versus, you know, making sure that one is taking the best action, which means more time, more analysis, and more delay.
So can I try out a proposal? This is Meg, because I totally hear what you're saying, Richard, and I agree that this is just a trade-off that puts everybody in a bit of a bind. So just to try this out on the DTSC folks, and you can tell me if this would not be, you know, if you're especially Colleen, if your initial sense is no, this could not fly given the statutory requirements.
Meg?
Yep.
Meg. The thing that I when you, both you and Richard, your discussion is it's good for us, but I'm sure Richard is going to respond. I am looking for, and from Richard, it's sort of like, what do you want from the system? And it's interesting that in the subcommittee one, where we had a discussion about AA infrastructure, they wanted to talk about tiering. Here, we're talking about tiering, and we are now locked into a discussion about the infrastructure of an AA. So
I actually have, this is about tiering.
Yeah, this is okay. So just let me go forth here. From Richard, I mean, it's sort of like, what do you want so that the entire system does call into effect the appropriateness or the level of approach to the factors A through M? And Meg, I hope you can list for us the things that you want, but also what to avoid. So with that, I mean, again, we're looking for the critical few. The staff are writing it down, and we need to be clear about what we need to retain in the record. So that's a small reminder. Go ahead. Sorry, Meg.
Thank you, Jeff. No problem. I'm open to redirection at any point. My proposal, just to put this on the table, and I'm coming up with this on the fly, is that start from those screening questions, and maybe they need refining. It's almost like to implement something along the line of REACH's pre-registration, that there is an alternatives assessment process that is applied to everything. So there's a first tier that everything has to go through. And that is that you have to answer the screening questions, identify potential alternatives, and then answer the screening questions, the three screening questions for each of the criteria, taking Tim Molloy's grouping of the A through M into those five groups of criteria. And what that allows the department then to do is that's an alternatives assessment that has been conducted, and that gives the department the ability to implement a regulatory response, which could be labeling, it could be, requiring end-of-life management, it could be requiring requests for more data, be a request for more data, and it could be saying you need to perform, okay, now you've identified the hot spots in the life cycle of this product that's primarily driving our reason for concern, and now you need to do this second tier of alternatives assessment. That's my recommendation.
So this is Kelly. I want to break in. Meg, you and Richard might want to take a look at that flowchart that we talked about at the earlier meeting, because you guys are driving towards exactly to the kinds of questions that Ken and Ann and I were working on, and we came up with this and presented at the meeting. And Meg, what you presented is extremely similar to what's in the flowchart.
And without prejudging, Meg, whether or not this is something the department wants to do, will do, what have you, I certainly think it's you're well within the realm of things that are legally plausible and appropriate. I don't think what you've proposed is at all a huge problem in terms of conformance with the statutory language.
Great.
I think that's kind of the spirit I was getting at too, Meg, which is that there may be the tiering may not The tiering might involve what level of assessment is necessary initially in order to take certain actions, and then be a later, more robust tier that follows that, as opposed to the entire, all of the tiers, whatever they are, having to be done before any regulatory response can be considered.
Any other comments from other members?
So this is Kelly. I'll just point everybody towards page 65 in the packet, that flowchart. I think what I heard is a description of the Tier 2 versus the focus follow-up assessment. And exactly what the Tier 1 versus Tier 2 is a good question, how those get defined and so forth. But in putting this together, we were thinking about the questions that Richard and Meg were just raising, plus the important questions of practicality and cost, because it didn't seem reasonable to require a manufacturer to spend a huge amount of money on something if there were an obvious answer or whatever, and to require detailed assessment of a huge array of topic areas where really the focus only needed to be on a few. And so this system was trying to deal with that, to put bounds around it, both in terms of time and cost and being able to move forward with those kinds of regulatory responses that are important for the externalized costs, such as those borne by local governments, for example. So if you guys pulled up, I'm just hearing a discussion that sounds very much like the discussion that we had in putting this together and the brief discussion that the larger group had a year ago over this flowchart on page 65 of the attachments to our packet.
Right. Thank you.
So this is Mike. I just want to ask Kelly a question about this. So what we're talking about, just a clarifying question, on this chart, the Tier 2 alternatives assessment would be closer to, you know, the Tier 1 that we're talking about now, and the follow-up assessment would be a more full-blown Tier 2 assessment.
Yeah, I think all the naming is really squishy here. The Tier 1 on this chart, the idea was that so many people would, as Mike had pointed out to me offline previously, as soon as you start listing things as potential chemicals or products that are going to be regulated, most folks are going to want to get themselves out of the regulatory chain if they can. And so what was written here is called Tier 1 was really make sure that you don't do something stupid without thinking it through. And the Tier 2 was really the first level of formal alternatives assessment that's described as more qualitative in nature. And but it could be more quantitative, and in fact, I think that's something that probably needs to be discussed as we try to advise the department to wrap their arms around it and what would be the trade-offs in that and cost. But I recognize that we're tiering and not the AA detail. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you, Odette. Odette still on the line? Odette.
Yep, I'm here.
Yeah, we had some initial observations about the hard work of Kelly and Ann and Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Offer any comment on that?
Well, that's really, when you go back to the first part of the paper, and I think it's Concept 2, that's really where Concept 2 came. And the only other comment, there was one, I guess, what I would call flaw in their proposal, and I think I tried to highlight it. And this is similar to some proposals the industry had put forward that relied on requiring manufacturers to comply with guidance to be prepared by the department in the future. And Colleen can probably speak to this more eloquently than I can, but basically we can only require compliance to something that is in place as of the date we adopt the regulations.
That's right, as we've talked about. But the simple fix is we take what was being proposed for guidance and we actually write it as text for the regulation.
Exactly.
Not much of an obstacle at all.
Yeah.
Just a point of clarification.
Yeah. It just means the work to develop the guidance needs to be done up front rather than later.
That's right. All right.
So this is Richard. I think the difference between concept two as summarized here and the concept that we've been talking about and that is captured to some degree in that flowchart that Kelly pointed us to is there's an intervening regulatory response between the tiers.
And that may be a challenge as well. We can have Colleen look at that and what it would take for us to implement that given our legal restraint.
So, yeah, okay. Well, that I think is that would be a really critical question, is if there is ultimately a desire to have a much more robust alternatives assessment, let's say, for the reasons like the ones Meg pointed out, that the ultimate solution may be an upstream substitution rather than a downstream restriction on disposal. But that downstream restriction on disposal is needed and can be implemented more quickly and addresses the main reason why the chemical is of concern, et cetera. is there a way to essentially get to the point to be able to do that and then follow that up with a more robust assessment, still having met the statutory requirement that an AA has to be done, maybe not the ultimate AA has to be done before a regulatory response can be identified.
Colleen, do you want to speak to that other than to say we need to look at it?
Well, other than I think Richard's done a really nice job of highlighting the
conundrum.
Yeah, but I think there's room to negotiate, especially if Corey and I were just sort of comparing notes. If the regulatory response were to say do the further or full-blown or final alternatives assessment.
Right.
So that's certainly one way of looking at it, but I do think we'll need to talk offline about a little more comprehensive way of looking at this sticky issue.
Yeah.
And just to that point, it does. I did notice that in the statute that little sentence that precedes the list of regulatory responses says, including but not limited to.
Yes, you're right.
So an additional regulatory response could be put in an end-of-life control and proceed to a more robust alternatives assessment.
Right, and we had actually something not quite that specific on point, but something somewhat akin to that in our last version of the draft regulations.
I think our challenge is not so much the scope of regulatory responses available to us, it's the robustness of the AA that must be completed before we can mandate such a response.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, hard to put Richard, Meg, and Kelly on the spot, but I would want one of you to review for us how the linkage or the concept or the infrastructure is in your mind of how you're linking the regulatory response to the AA and to the level or robustness or to the degree of completeness that an AA is done. So that is going back to how are all those linked to the tiering of the approach for the AA. I'd like you to review that. That's just for the rest of the committee and also for the staff that's taking notes, in your view.
Maybe I could try to say something to at least one piece of that. This is Meg. I guess I'd like to emphasize that in my reading of it, the statute doesn't require that a regulatory response hinge on the findings of an alternative assessment. Now, you may say that that's, it makes sense, But a lot, as Richard has pointed out, a lot of those potential regulatory responses aren't actually even informed by the presence of alternatives or whether they're preferable according to what attributes. So the only statutory link between an alternatives assessment and a regulatory response is a temporal one, that the regulatory response has to come after the alternatives assessment is completed. So my sense is that it makes sense to take a regulatory or provide have one tier of alternatives assessment that's done for everything that consists of some of these screening questions and an initial flag of known better alternatives. And subsequent to that, the department can take a regulatory response, such as labeling or requesting more data. And to me, there's also requesting a more robust alternatives assessment that, I could imagine it containing many things, like you actually have to consider these three other alternatives that were brought forward to us, to the department, or you need to do a detailed, analysis of the water quality impact, because those are what the screening questions have called out as a hot spot of the product and the alternative. So rather than at the outset saying, presupposing what regulatory action you want to take and therefore requiring some level of alternatives assessment, that tier one be the alternatives assessment that everybody does and that elucidates the first round of regulatory response. Does that clear it up at all?
Yeah. Thank you.
And actually, I'd be happy to put this idea in writing as my homework.
Nice.
That would really help, Meg. I'm intrigued, but I have some reservations, just to be candid, as we speak about this approach, but I'm very curious to see you develop it a little more in writing.
Right. That is your homework so far.
Okay.
Any other comments?
Yeah, this is Kelly.
You want a homework assignment too?
Well, I think I already did the homework, and you all have the results. So I'll just point you back at that flow chart again. And what we're really talking about now starts in the middle where it's got the orange box and what's called the Tier 2 AA in this purpose. But it all is laid out on the chart, so I'm not going to read it all again for everyone. But the basic idea of this concept is to make sure that all of the issues are thought about at least a screening level before any action is taken, and that the costs are minimized, so the costs and hassle of that are minimized. If there's an obvious alternative, if there's an obvious thing that needs to be studied in a lot more detail, in either case, that first round doesn't take that long and isn't that expensive for the manufacturers. This makes it a lot more practical, a lot less daunting, and eliminates unnecessary detail for everyone involved. So that's what the Tier 2 AA is supposed to do. And then at that point, either there's no need to do more study, or if there is need to do more study, that's been identified and there's a plan proposed by the manufacturer to do that, that the department would be free to comment on and direct as a follow-up this focused follow-up assessment, which is effectively a more detailed, focused assessment on those particular topic areas that require more information and more study. And to help clarify what that is, since it sounds like some folks are familiar with the CEQA analogy, I would see the Tier 2 AA as constructed here as being analogous to an initial study and a negative declaration. So if it's all clear cut and there isn't a lot that needs to be done, it's kind of like a neg deck. You do the neg deck and you're done. Otherwise, it's the initial study that focuses, it provides the basis for a focused environmental impact report where you study just those specific areas where more detailed investigation is warranted. So the focused follow-up assessment would be akin to a focused environmental impact report. The only difference is that there would be, unlike in CEQA, if you go to an initial study and then you do the focused EIR, there's not a decision point in the middle. With this process, that initial work, because it would also serve the function of a neg deck, would allow a decision-making point to occur before the more detailed study. Does that clarify?
Thank you. Kelly, can I ask you a question? And I can ask you more about this offline to inform what I write, but would you be open to, on your flowchart, the thing that's called Tier 1 AA, would you be open to not calling that an AA, and what you have as Tier 2 AA becomes the first tier?
Yeah, these names are just names based on discussion with various folks, and we were trying to figure out what to call things. At one point, they were called Tier 1, 2, and 3. One of them wasn't called a Tier 1 for a while. They're just names. So the naming is unimportant.
So this is Richard. Let me just comment, because I think the concept of having the intervening regulatory response, I think, is in common here. I think the difference in what I was saying versus what, Kelly, that part of your flowchart does, is that I'm trying to, that there are options, regulatory responses, that really do not depend on the determination as to whether or not there's a viable alternative. And this is written, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but it's written to still hinge on the question of whether a viable alternative is identified in the Tier 2 alternatives assessment or not.
No.
And what I'm trying to get to is something that would provide for regulatory responses to be imposed that can be imposed independent of whether or not there's an alternative.
Richard, this is Kelly. No, your take on that is not the way that at least Ann and Ken and I saw it, and it's not how it's written in the chart, or at least it wasn't our intent to write it that way.
Okay. And then the other thing that's quite different here, I think, is that what you're calling the Tier 1 assessment actually precedes even the prioritization of products, et cetera, right? So that's quite different than what we're talking about now, which would be something that would only apply to prioritized products.
And, Richard, this is Kelly. Just to clarify again, the second part, the focused follow-up assessment would only be necessary if there wasn't an obvious alternative. There was something that needed more study. And the whole idea of the Tier 1 was recognizing that as soon as the department starts creating lists, people are going to start creating new products. So how that fits in regulatorily and what that means is not something we're really talking about today, but it is a recognition that people will be changing their products as soon as the department starts putting something on the table.
Okay, thank you for your discussion. We are now at about 20 minutes to 12. I think we have gone through 2A, 2B, and we've discussed many elements of 2B, sort of. So I think in your homework, you will probably provide us with a bit more specificity and detail, recognizing the time, because there are 20 minutes or so left. I would like to move on to question 2D, which is what should be the circumstances or conditions for allowing a manufacturer to conduct a lower tier AA? So I'd like to hear some discussion and input on that question. Floor is open.
Well, this is Mike. I think, you know, the way the discussion has gone, it sounds to me like we've inserted the screening AA, Tier 1 AA, into the process under every condition. You have to go through this. And it's only the more extensive and comprehensive or perhaps focused tier that is done on an as-needed basis. So I think perhaps the question is reversed. We need to ask the other question. Under what circumstances will a manufacturer need to conduct a full-blown alternatives assessment or a deep dive into one or the other assessment criteria groupings?
Thank you. Any comments related to that? It's an important observation.
I don't have any comments right now.
Okay. Dr. Dennison?
So, okay. So, I think the primary trigger should be one that is related to DTSC's decision as to what range of regulatory responses it sees as either needed or desirable that would be informed by better information about alternatives. So let me say what I mean by that. So if they have in fact already gone through a screening level assessment and decided that there are some regulatory responses that could be done in the near term, but that the ultimate and preferred solution would be to expedite or to move toward an alternative, should one exist. So that would be regulatory responses associated with prohibiting the use of a chemical, et cetera, that where they would not want to impose that kind of regulatory condition without knowing what consequence it would have in terms of what substitution it would drive. That would be the trigger for requiring a more in-depth second or higher tier alternatives assessment. So it would be the screening level assessment done, consideration of what regulatory responses are appropriate or needed, given that level of analysis, and whether there would be additional options for regulatory response that would be desired or needed and would need to be informed by a much more robust understanding of what the alternatives are. And if DTSC made that finding, then that would be the trigger for the more detailed alternatives assessment.
Any other comments?
I have more of a question, and this is kind of for everybody, not just for DTSC. But this is Meg. What is the – I'm thinking about REACH, and its ability to request that a company make the case that something is essential. So I'm thinking about, are there easy ways to reduce exposure to chemicals of concern in priority products because their use is deemed non-essential? And is there any way that this product that this process can contribute to that? So, for example, certain components of fragrances or things like that that are not critical to the key function of the product. And I understand this raises a bunch of thorny issues about sort of in whose eye is that essential? Are squeezy toys even essential, period? But I guess I just want to put that out as
is there a way that the alternatives assessment process could contribute to informing the identification of potentially non-essential uses of chemicals of concern in priority products?
Anyone have a follow-up for Meg?
This is Mike. I'm trying to think about that. I mean, manufacturers are so driven to reduce costs that they're not going to put something non-essential in there because it's nice. I mean, you can call coloring things non-essential. They can all be kind of a bland whitish grayish color if you want. I mean, ultimately, I think that's part of the alternative assessment is if you can eliminate it, then you've found a way to accomplish the same function that you accomplished with this priority chemical or whatever it's called before, because it's not going to be in there for no reason at all. There's got to be a reason. If there is no reason, you're going to eliminate it and reduce your cost.
Well, I guess I mean non-essential, like from society's priorities. Like, is it essential that we have a lemon scent if it's made of a carcinogen?
They're going to find a way to produce a lemon scent with a non-carcinogenic substance, and that's the point of this, is to drive the use of green chemistry, right? So that's fine. I mean, people like lemon scents. They're great.
So Mike, here's the problem, though. Maybe this gets to the definition of an alternative, where that definition needs to encompass the concept that one of the alternatives is to not use anything for that. So let's say a company has five different flavors of air freshener, and they come up with a sixth that smells like raspberry, and that chemical turns out to be a chemical of concern. And they're required to do an alternatives assessment. If one of the alternatives is, well, forget about having a raspberry flavor because there's not an alternative to making it raspberry, that to me ought to be in the realm of what would be considered an alternative. But if alternative is defined as we can either continue to use what we have now because there are no alternative raspberry flavors, and the only way we can be made not to be able to continue to use that is that we have to be able to find an alternative raspberry flavor. That is kind of an outcome that I think is questionable. Now, I realize we're on a slippery slope, and what's essential for one observer may not be for another, et cetera. But maybe the way to deal with this is to say that one of the alternatives that has to be assessed is to do without the chemical of concern in that product of concern.
Well, I think that's the regulatory response. It's restricted. That chemical is restricted. You can't use it. And if you can't use it and there's no alternative, then you can't have a raspberry-scented room freshener. So, and if you really want one, then you have the guidance that you need to go and research and develop something that will replace it. And that's totally up to the manufacturer.
So the thing that has me nervous about this, because it may be implicit that DTLC has that authority, but one could certainly interpret that only if an alternative is found could DTLC impose that kind of a ban. And I can imagine legal cases that hinge on that question. In other words, the legislature said you must do an alternatives assessment before you can regulate this chemical, and that implies that if there's not an alternative, you can't regulate it, or you can't ban it, at least.
No, Richard, I have to jump in here, Colleen. I don't think you should read that into it. I think it means we cannot undertake the full and final selection of the regulatory response until the alternative assessment has occurred, whatever the selected or range of alternatives is. But we're not limited to imposing a regulatory response, including the product ban, to only those situations where we find no safer alternative. We have the full panoply of regulatory responses we can impose based on what's appropriate in light of what the alternatives assessment yielded. So I think your view of when and what product regulatory responses we can take is a little too limited.
Is there any reason, Colleen, why one could not require within the scope of what alternatives are examined the alternative of foregoing that chemical in that product? It's kind of like the, one of the NEPA-type scenarios that you have to consider.
So, Liz, if I understand your question correctly, I would rephrase, see if I got it right. Department have the authority to require that the alternatives assessment include an examination of elimination of the use of the chemical of concern altogether.
Right.
Because I'm so kind of wedded, as it were, to Mike's view of that's really the appropriate inquiry at the regulatory response, I don't think we have looked at that. So let me ponder that, and maybe the next time we reconvene, I can have a more cogent answer for you.
Because I think that gets to Meg's concern while addressing, Mike, your point. And I think the thing that has a lot of us nervous about this temporal placing of the alternatives assessment in front of the regulatory response, even though I hear what you're saying, Colleen, that is that there's a strong implication that somehow the outcome of the alternatives assessment is the primary driver or determinant of the regulatory response. And that, therefore, if no alternative is found, that has implications for whether or not a certain type of regulatory response could be taken.
Right. That's been the prevailing view, that the alternatives assessment informs the regulatory response. That's the primary reason why it was placed, as some on the call are phrasing it, temporally. Think of it more as sort of, consequential causal connection before the regulatory response. So I think we've all flagged the same concern.
So if DTSC had information that indicated that a chemical could be proceeded without, that it was not essential, or that the economic consequences of not having it available for that use in that product would not be significant, or what have you, that by including that explicitly as one of the alternatives that needs to be included in the alternatives assessment, that information would be available to inform the regulatory decision that might lead to saying that, okay, so you don't need it, do without it.
I understand your point, and I agree with you. If that were explicitly considered, we'd have more to point to as we selected the regulatory response. I do need to kind of explore that a little further, though, and where, time is not so much of the essence. I take your point, Richard, and we'll talk again when we reconvene.
This is Kelly.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I'd just like to break in and take us back to the tiering thing that we're here to talk about. I think we've been spending a lot of time talking about regulatory response because we see that they're inextricably interlinked. But I'd like to provide advice that is perhaps a little different than Richard provided earlier regarding what one does after the first, the what is called the Tier 2 AA on the little flowchart that Ken and Ann and I came up with, I think I would strongly advise against the department limiting which regulatory responses it would be able to use after that AA. I think it would be unwise to do so because it could create the unnecessary study and unnecessary expense on behalf of the manufacturer and unnecessarily tie the hands of the department. So I would think that the department should leave open all of its regulatory responses after what's structured here as the Tier 2 AA. So, and then the other thing I just want to say about the tiering is that the one of the most important parts of the tiering concept is to put bounds on the cost, the effort, the time involved in doing alternatives assessments so that it becomes a finite, practical, realistic process and that expense detailed analysis and the expense and time that go with it would only be necessary where warranted, where the decision-making was hard.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. It is now almost 12 o'clock, and I'd like to end this session. And actually, I thank you, Kelly. You actually summarized the goal of this subcommittee and its discussion very well. I see that there is everybody's different thoughts, which there is some cohesion around some approaches to tiering. I see there's some thoughts about the dynamic relationship between regulatory responses and the results of an AA and the apparent dislinking, the appearance of a dislinking between options available under regulatory responses and the results that may occur from an AA. It's clear that the screening level AA approach being put forward and that there's a call for a more in-depth AA if it's warranted. I would like to ask for people's thoughts on rule sets that would lead us to judging whether or not a screening level AA is good enough and to the rule sets as to what parts would be important to be included again in an in-depth AA. And I've heard that here on and off. The last thing to remind everyone is that we will have a second meeting on June 14th. So in preparation for June 14th, I would hope that all of you can complete your homework assignments, which I would ask that you submit them to Kathy Ono-Dett by Friday. I think it's Friday, June the 10th, so we can redistribute it to everyone, and we can then that'll form the basis of the discussion that we can move along on the again on the 14th. Does that sound reasonable to everyone?
Did you want the homework to consist of a concise summary of their crystallized views if they have them?
Answering the questions?
Yeah, answering the questions. And again, I'm trying to be methodical, so it's like the critical view. What are the points that you want to have to be maintained in the record as your view for the department to consider? Yes, go ahead, Kathy.
A few things about that. If you could be complete but concise, so 1.5 to 2 pages would be plenty. And please put your name on the document, especially if you PDF it. When you PDF it and you don't have your name on it, then we have to go through a lot of thank you.
All right. With that, thank you, Dr. Kortz. Thank you, Dr. Kirshner, Dr. Moran, Dr. Schwartzman, Dr. Dennison. Thank you, Dr. Wallen, for joining us from Switzerland. And thank you, all the other stakeholders and public that have been involved in this conference call. And call is now over. Thank you.
Thank you.